أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
And welcome you once again to Islam in Focus. Today we have our 50th program on Jesus, beloved messenger of Allah, and our 17th on sin, atonement, and the sacrifice. And inshallah we will continue with the crucifixion. I'm your host, Ishad Nuresh, and here once again from St. Mary's University is Dr. Jim Arvedo. As-salamu alaykum, Dr. Jim.
Wa alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
For the benefit of our viewers, like we usually like to do, how about a summary of last week's program?
Okay, last week was the 8th section dealing with the analysis of the story of crucifixion. And we used the chart in which we explained the 7 basic differences in the events of crucifixion, preparation for crucifixion, who carried the cross, what was given to Jesus before crucifixion, what was the reaction of the 2 robbers who were crucified with him, what was the physiology of the cry on the cross, how did the inscription on the cross read, and also the events relating to the things that happened immediately after the crucifixion. We also discussed some of the problems that related to that, which included the appearance of the angel to strengthen him, and we indicated, of course, God incarnate does not need strengthening from anyone, and even then, if we were to interpret that strengthening, it means that the angel was assuring him that God will save him from crucifixion, which would be a reasonable interpretation too. Secondly, we discussed the prayers attributed to Jesus in the moment of despair, seeking that this cup will be taken away from him, which we said, according to the belief introduced by Paul, this would be a negation of the basic mission of Jesus, and that is to die as ransom for mankind. The third issue was the running away of the disciples, and as such we lost the most important and authentic eyewitnesses who were very close to Jesus, and most of the narrations say that they were looking from a distance or at a distance. And finally we ended up with the discussion of the breaking of the legs of Jesus, the 2 robbers crucified around Jesus, and we indicated that this very curious type of order which is described in John chapter 19, that Jesus was crucified in the middle, the 2 robbers were on either side of him. And then it says they broke the leg of the first robber and then went on to the second robber and then came again to Jesus. And we said that that's very strange because Jesus is right there in the middle. Why skip him and come back? And we said that this does not seem to really click. And it raises a question, actually, as some scholars believe, that this part actually was a later addition to the story.
I'm going to have to ask you to explain that order of the breaking of the legs before I go on. How would you explain that?
Well, I think there is one of two possibilities. Either that it did happen or it didn't happen. If it did happen, it means then that it would be up to the author of the Gospel according to John to explain. I can't explain it for him. He described it, but he didn't give any reason why the soldiers followed that strange order of breaking the legs.
So that's up to him to explain.
It's up to him to explain. I cannot take that role for him. But if we say that it probably did not happen, which I believe is the case, then perhaps we must find convincing reasons, we must be able to supply reasons which make the story really doubtful, in fact. So far, I'm not aware of any writer who particularly addressed that point. There may be that I didn't read for, but I reflected on this issue, tried to find out what could be the possible reasons. First of all, none of the synoptic gospels, the first 3 synoptic gospels, mentioned this particular event. And obviously, breaking the legs is something which can be easily or more easily visible from a distance, much more so than identification of the identity of the those who are put on the cross, especially due to the fact that no mention is made, not only in the three synoptic gospels, but more importantly in the oldest of them, that is the gospel according to Mark. Secondly, according to the same gospel where that story is mentioned, the gospel according to John, more specifically chapter 19 verse 30, we are told that Jesus said, bowed his head first of all, and he said, "It is finished," and gave up his spirit. That's quotation, and gave up his spirit. And then later on it says that the soldiers started to break the legs. Now, if the soldiers were able to see Jesus bowing his head and saying it is all finished, and were able to see him giving up the spirit, as verse 30 indicates, then how come they just discovered that he was dying when they came to break the legs? You see, in verse 33 of the same chapter it says, "But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs." So it means that just like they just discovered it, but that was not the case. They should have known that before. So it doesn't seem to be consistent, really. The story could have been more believable, for example, if the text in John said that the Jews demanded the breaking of the legs of the two robbers, because they already saw Jesus giving up the spirit, so there was no need really to break his leg, and that the soldiers broke the legs of the two robbers, and because they saw Jesus giving up the spirit, they did not break his leg. If the story appeared like that, perhaps it might have appeared more believable. On the other hand, it says also that the Jews asked Pilate to give the permission to break the legs of all three. Now, how much time did it take for the Jews to go from the site of crucifixion to Jerusalem to arrange to meet with Pilate, who would not just be available very readily like any other governor, and to take the permission, and then to go back to carry this instruction to the soldiers, unless we say that Pilate was present at the moment of crucifixion? But if Pilate were present at the time of crucifixion, is it reasonable that all gospel writers totally ignored his presence? There's no mention at all of that. Another reason, fourth reason, is that the writer of the gospel according to John seems to be conscious that some people may not accept his report. Mm-hmm. He seems to be worried about that. In verse 35 of the same chapter 19, he says, and I quote, "He who saw it has borne witness. His testimony is true, and he knows that he tells the truth." This is one of the most problematic statements in the Bible, because most Bible scholars, as we mentioned before, believe that the writer of that gospel in all likelihood is not one of the disciples of Jesus, not John the son of Zebedee, who was one of the disciples, but that the writer of that particular verse seemed to be referring to another person. It says, "He who saw it," you see, a witness. He did not say, for example, "I, by virtue of being a disciple of Jesus, an eyewitness, I saw it," or simply says, "I saw that happening." He says, "He who saw it." Why is he referring to someone else? So that's very curious. And if John actually was referring, or were referring to himself as a witness, John the disciple, why doesn't he say, for example, "And I know I am telling the truth"? Mm-hmm. Why he says, "And he knows he tells the truth"? See, why is this ambiguity in the expression? That's quite a problem. Another reason is that the writer of the gospel according to John could not help but mention the reason for that incident. See, he had a particular purpose in mind which he could not hide. We find him stating later in verse 36, quote, "For these things took place that the scripture might be fulfilled, not a bone of him shall be broken." In fact, what John here is referring to, perhaps, as we discussed in a previous program on the prophecies about crucifixion in the New Testament, as believed by some, is actually referring to the Psalm of David, Psalm number 34, verse 20, which says that a bone of him will not be broken. And we have already indicated before that in discussing these Psalms in totality, in the context in which these verses appear, not a bone of him will be broken actually mean that he will be totally saved to the point that no bone even will be broken.
Okay.
Not that he will be killed and stabbed in the side, but still his bones are not broken. Because what difference does it make if you're dead, whether your bones
are intact or not?
It talks about salvation. And this is more so, more clear, when you examine that psalm as we did in a previous program, Psalm number 34. The same person who said that his bones will not be broken says that God has listened to my prayer. It talks about God saving him. It talks about the angels of God encamping around that righteous person. Well, that all of these reasons, when we reflect upon them, seem to lead us to the conclusion that this, in fact, was perhaps a later addition. Even though the other synoptic gospels didn't mention anything about that, so the only explanation possibly would be theological reasons, regardless of historicity, as has been the case in many other narrations in the gospels.
Let us now examine the issue of resurrection. Now, how did this event come to be known?
Well, it appears that the news about resurrection began to spread very slowly among early Christians. There is ample evidence, and we'll come to that in the Gospels, that Peter and the disciples denied that, rejected it, and suspected it when they heard it. And above all, even after, according to the Gospels, they became sure that it did happen, they never talked about that as the foundation of faith in God. They didn't take this notion of resurrection and crucifixion as the basis for salvation. In fact, one famous biblical scholar, we mentioned his name before, George Caird, C-A-I-R-D, says that the first witness about resurrection did not really come from the Gospels. In other words, it was written before that in a letter by Paul in the Corinthians, his first letter to the Corinthians, in chapter 15, verses 3 and 4, which is believed by biblical scholars to have been written about 10 years before the writing of the oldest of the Gospels, Mark. And in that, Paul even says that this is what he received. Again, we stop at the word received. What does it mean? Received by way of information from other disciples of Jesus or other eyewitnesses, or received by way of revelation, as he claimed several times that he now is receiving direct revelation. This is not very clear. But in any case, the story of resurrection, like the story of crucifixion also, does not really appear in a consistent way in the four Gospels.
Now, maybe at this time I'd like to go back to the chart that you prepared, in particular to see how the stories compare in the four Gospels.
In terms of the factual information.
Exactly. Factual. And I think you'd be better explained with the visual effect of the chart.
We have on the chart six areas of comparison, beginning with box number 28. And the first question here is, who went to the tomb? Okay? Now, according to Mark, there were three people. Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James, and Salome, or Salome, S-A-L-O-M-E.
So they all went to the tomb?
Yeah, three of them. Yeah. So the number here, according to Mark, is three. Chapter 16, verse 1. In the Gospel according to Matthew, there were only two Marys. It simply says Mary the Magdalene, another Mary, or the other Mary. That's chapter 28, verse 1. Okay? In the Gospel according to Luke, several women went. Not three or two, several of them. It speaks about the two Marys, and Joanna and the other women also who came with Jesus from Galilee. This references has to be put together. It appears in chapter 23 in Luke, verses 27 and 55 to 56, and also in chapter 24, verses 1 to 3 and verse 10. I mean, if you put all these pieces together, it is obvious that there were several women who went.
Mm-hmm.
In the Gospel according to John, only one person went to the tomb, and that is Mary the Magdalene. That's chapter 20, verse 1. So here again we have a great variation in a very simple incident as to who went first or arrived at the tomb. The only common denominator in all of those variant stories is Mary the Magdalene, of which or from which it is said that Jesus has driven seven demons. And that would leave us with that woman as the most important or fundamental source of all that has been said about resurrection.
You've come up with a number of observations here on the resurrection. Are there any other before we...
Yes. If we move, for example, to 29, box 29, the question arises as to when did these women go? In the Gospel according to Mark, it was after sunrise, 16:2. According to Matthew, it was towards dawn, 28:1. According to Luke, it was at early dawn, 24, verse 1. According to John, it was while it was still dark, chapter 20, verse 1. Well, you might be able to reconcile Matthew, Luke, and John. It is about or around dawn time. But Mark is quite different. He specifically says that they went after sunrise. This, again, are factual things that should not really be different. In box number 30, speaking about the stone and how the stone was removed that was blocking the graveyard or the tomb, according to Mark, it says that they saw the stone rolled back. According to Matthew, it says an earthquake happened and an angel came down, rolled the stone, and sat upon it outside. Chapter 28, verse 2. According to Luke and John, both, they found that the stone was rolled away or taken away. 24:2 in Luke and 20, verse 1 in John. Again, things doesn't seem to match in a very simple description like that. In box 31, another question is raised. Who was there? What did the women see in the tomb or outside? Well, according to Mark, it says that they saw a young man sitting inside, young man in a white robe. According to Matthew, it was an angel sitting outside, 28:2. According to Luke, it was two men who stood behind them. 24 verses 4 and 5. According to John, there is no mention of anyone being sighted when the disciples came, but it says that when Mary stayed there and continued to cry, then she saw two angels, one at the head where Jesus was buried and the other at his feet. And then when she turned around, she found Jesus standing but did not recognize him. Again, the story is quite obvious. Whether it's one young man, one angel, two men, two angels, there's pieces of information that doesn't seem to match really. In box 32, the question is, what were the instructions given to the women or the woman who came to see? Well, according to Mark, it simply said that Jesus is going to meet you. Chapter 16, verses 6 and 7. A similar story is given in Matthew. I think it's reconcilable that Jesus is going to meet you. That's in chapter 28, verses 5 to 7. But Luke, however, gives us a different version. It doesn't say that the angels asked the women to do any particular thing. They simply, the angels reminded them only, why are you seeking for the living among the dead? you should remember what he told you and all that, but they didn't simply give any instruction. John, on the other hand, doesn't say much about that. In box 33, whether these instructions were carried out or not, we find again variations. In the Gospel according to Mark, it indicates that they said nothing to anyone. They didn't say anything. They didn't carry out the instruction given by whoever told them, angels or individuals. That's chapter 16, verse 8. According to Matthew, they told the disciples. Doesn't mention other than the disciples. 28, verse 8. In the Gospel according to Luke, they told the 11 and all the rest, the disciple plus. In the Gospel according to John, they told Peter and the disciple who was loved by Jesus, purportedly perhaps John, the son of Zebedee. In the case of Luke, it's chapter 24, verse 9. In the case of John, it's chapter 20, verse 2. A biblical scholar, George Caird, noticed also that according to Luke, in the Gospel according to Luke, the appearance of Jesus took place in Jerusalem and its surrounding, and according to Mark, it took place in Galilee. So like the events of crucifixion, also we find that the narratives pertaining to resurrection are quite different.
That's a big discrepancy.
It is a big discrepancy. One cannot simply say that somebody was describing part of the event and the other is describing the other part. The story seems to be to be truthful, of a very doubtful authenticity.
Dr. Jamal, are there any other observations that maybe you'd like to tell us about the resurrection?
There are a few. For example, according to another biblical scholar, Dennis Nineham, he said that it is very difficult really to have any certitude about the reason why these women visited the tomb where Jesus was supposed to be buried. Some of the Gospels say that they went to anoint him. And Nineham indicates that many commentators agree with Montefiore that the reason, or this reason, is very, very improbable. There are a number of observations here. First of all, according to Mark, the body of Jesus was not anointed at all after his death on the cross. However, according to John chapter 19, verse 40, it says that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus took the body of Jesus after crucifixion, and it says, according to the customs of the Jews, they bound it in linen cloth with spices.
Mm-hmm.
The question here is this. If Mary the Magdalene, or Mary Magdalene and the other women, went to anoint Jesus on Sunday morning or Sunday early, the question here is this. Was this really a custom of the Jews to anoint the body after it has already been buried for one day and two nights? Definitely not to the best of our knowledge. Mm-hmm. I don't know of any people who do that. The second question is that a body which has already been there for one day and two nights would be expected scientifically to begin to decay.
Right.
And the smell, of course, would not be very pleasant. Did Mary the Magdalene expect to do the anointing of the body which has already begun, mm-hmm. supposedly, to be decomposed? And if we were to take the version of the Gospel according to John, how would you expect a lonely woman, Mary Magdalene alone, because he didn't say other women went, he just mm-hmm. say Mary Magdalene alone, single woman, to go to the tomb in the darkness, when it's still dark, in order to anoint a dead body? And if we accept the version of Matthew, who alone mentioned this notion that there were guards already guarding the grave of Jesus, and that the rock was already sealed so that there would be no way of tampering with it, which, by the way, John Fenton believed that were all addition of the own working of Matthew. But even if we take that version, how did Mary Magdalene, or others for that matter, expect to gain any access to the grave in order to anoint Jesus, knowing that the soldiers are standing guard there,
right.
and that the rock is sealed? Okay? That is, of course, on the assumption that they knew exactly where Jesus was placed, and there was no problem or error whatsoever in identifying where he was buried. No wonder we find some biblical scholars like Frank Morrison, in his book Who Moved the Stone, comment on this variation of the story about the women visiting the tomb. And he said that this matter seemed to have been forgotten in the early days because the disciples and the followers of Christ were busy with more difficult and more important problems. But as soon things became to settle down a little, the story appeared again and was incorporated or added to the teachings of the church, and then began to spread in the churches of Asia and Europe. And out of those variety of versions that spread in various churches, it appears that Matthew and Luke based their narrations.
How about the reports of the sighting of Jesus after the resurrection?
Okay, let us go back again to what biblical scholars have said about the order of writing the Gospels. And we mentioned that in a previous program, that the oldest of the Gospels, according to them, is the Gospel according to Mark, which was actually the basis for the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. Now, it is interesting to notice that the report about sighting Jesus after resurrection, which appeared in some of the older manuscripts of the Gospel according to Mark, is believed by some biblical scholars not to be of the work of Mark, but rather some addition that was introduced later on after his Gospel was written. In fact, they say that this addition probably took place about the year 180, which means about 120 years after Mark was supposed to have written his Gospel. For that reason, if you check the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, you notice that chapter 16, verses 9 through 20, has been already dropped from the body of the chapter, just relegated to a footnote. A biblical scholar, a very famous one, Dennis Nineham, says, in fact, that the Revised Standard Version of the Bible was quite correct in considering Matthew 19, chapter 19, verses 9 to 20, to consider it unauthentic and to relegate it to a footnote. And he bases that also on the opinion given by the famous Catholic scholar Lagrange, in which he says that the that this particular section, 9 to 20, is not of the work of Mark. There are a number of reasons given.
Mm-hmm.
One, that the best and most authentic copies of the Gospel according to Mark end with chapter 16, verse 8. There is nothing, verses 19 to 20 is not there, which speaks about the appearance of Jesus, peace be upon him. Second reason is that even some of the other manuscripts that does not end at verse 8, like the best copies, the Gospels which even give different conclusion to that chapter 16, still agrees with the best copies in dropping verses 9 through 20. In other words, they might have different kind of conclusion, but nothing to do with the Jesus being cited by others. A third reason is that many of the very famous scholars of the 4th century, like Jerome, have clearly stated that these verses 9 through 20 is not, or was not in his time, in existence in the best Greek manuscripts available to them or known to them, and it was not quoted except once or twice in everything that was written that's outside the Gospels until the year 325. The fourth reason is an analytical reason. The biblical scholar had noted that the style of this section, verses 9 to 20, is quite different from the style of the rest of the Gospel, that the vocabulary used in that particular section is more like the vocabulary of the second century rather than nearly the middle of the first century at the time when Mark wrote his Gospel. No wonder we find a biblical scholar like John Fenton, F-E-N-T-O-N, says that the appearance of Jesus to people, according to Matthew, is of the addition of Matthew, and that even the gospel that speaks about the sighting of Jesus are quite questionable. Mm-hmm. We have no time to explore why, but perhaps we can get to that.
Maybe. Thank you very much, Dr. Bedawi, and thank you all for joining us here once again in Islam in Focus. As always, your comments and your questions will be appreciated. From all of us, assalamu alaikum.
أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمدا رسول